is that a bunch of technology geeks on the West Coast of the United, primarily on the West Coast of the United States, have iterated and experimented their way into a set of practices for running a company that are a better match with our super weird, super unique human nature. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Welcome to Peer Spectrum, where we journey through medicine's overlooked and unexplored corners. Experience what it's like practicing medicine on the International Space Station, operating on an NFL Super Bowl quarterback, treating remote patients in Antarctica, or flying over the burning reactor at Chernobyl. Ride along with a former Navy SEAL physician embedded with elite Delta Force commandos. Meet renowned physicians, economists, researchers, and journalists deconstructing subjects as diverse as psychedelics, meditation, science crowdfunding, artificial intelligence, architecture, and more. Join orthopedic surgeon Dr. Keith Mankin, Colin Miller, and our growing tribe as we explore medicine en route.
All right, welcome back. There's no shortage of books on Silicon Valley, with a quick Amazon search yielding over 40,000 results. Our guest today believes that most, if not all, of these books have overlooked a crucial element in the story: how these high-tech, disruptive, and revolutionary companies are actually run, how they implement and cultivate an organizational culture that is, quote, freewheeling, fast-moving, egalitarian, evidence-driven, argumentative, and autonomous, unquote. Today, we're thrilled to have Andrew McAfee with us. Andrew is a principal research scientist at the MIT Sloan School of Management and co-founder and co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. His latest book, The Geek Way, is best described by Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, who happened to write the foreword to his book. Quote, "By combining management theory, competitive strategy, the science of evolution, psychology, military history, and cultural anthropology, he has produced a remarkable work of synthesis. This work, which he dubs The Geek Way, finally explains with a single unified theory the reasons why the tech startup approach has taken over much of the world." Unquote. This is a great conversation. We really enjoyed having Andrew with us and hope you do as well. With that said, let's get started.
Andy, welcome to the show. This is a Monday and next Monday is Christmas, so it's certainly a busy time of the year. So thanks for jumping on so soon here.
It's a pleasure to have a break from planning and Christmas shopping and getting all that last minute stuff done. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. All right, we're going to jump into something some of our listeners will know about, some won't. But tell us about Ignaz Semmelweis. Who was this guy and why didn't people listen to him?
So I wrote a book about geeks and the kinds of companies that they're building. And one of the stories that I came across that helped me set the stage for the book is the story of this guy whose name was Ignaz Semmelweis. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that very poorly. He was a physician in what we would now call Austria in the middle of the 19th century. And he really meets my definition of a geek, because to me, a geek is an obsessive maverick. It's somebody who dives in on a really hard, really important problem, can't let it go, is extremely tenacious. And here's the other important part. If these ideas and the solutions they come up with are very far from the mainstream, from established practice, or from the status quo, the geeks don't care. They will go where their solutions take them, even if it's pretty far off the beaten path. So with all that as preamble, Semmelweis is one of the great tragic figures, I think, in the history of medicine and in the history of having fantastic ideas, because he had a fantastic and critically important idea and he couldn't get people to listen to him. So he was put in charge of the maternity clinics in one of the main Vienna hospitals in the middle of the 19th century. And the important thing to keep in mind about those clinics is that they were killing women at an alarming rate when they went in to give birth. The death rates in some months were like 10%. And like you guys probably know, maternal sepsis, what they used to call childbed fever, is a terrible, terrible way to die. Relatively slow, it's painful, and it leaves this poor newborn without a mother. And we have to keep in mind, back in the middle of the 19th century, we didn't quite know why it was happening. And so Semmelweis was put in charge of these two clinics, and the death rates were astonishingly bad, and he tried to figure out what was going on. And he had one clue at the start. The clue was that the clinics had very uneven death rates. One of the clinics was staffed by medical residents, medical students. That one had the high death rates. The other one was staffed by midwives. And the death rates were still, by our standards, astonishingly high, but a lot lower. And so Semmelweis said, okay, that's where I dig in. I have to understand the differences between these two clinics. And he was just super systematic, super geeky about it. And he realized that the medical residents usually came to their birth clinic right from doing autopsies. And autopsies were not part of the curriculum for a midwife at that time. So they weren't doing any. So they didn't come into their birth clinic having just been elbows deep in a dead person. And Semmelweis says, okay, now I've got a clue. And then he just started trying to figure out, why would that make a difference? Honestly, they did not know at this point in time. At one of the most medically advanced, technologically advanced economies in the world, they had no idea why that would have made a difference. So Semmelweis dove in and he did all kinds of things. And what he wound up doing was realizing that the medical resident's hands smelled like a corpse and the midwife's didn't. And he said, great, this is my only clue. What can I do to make the hands of the medical students stop smelling so bad? And he came up with a solution, an incredibly caustic solution using lime that finally got the smell out of the medical students' hands. And he said, okay, that's what I got to work with. Off we go. And he instituted the first mandatory hand washing, I believe, in the history, at least, of Western medicine. And sure enough, he backed into the cause of the problem. And once medical students had to wash their hands before assisting in deliveries, the birth rates plummeted. And in a couple months, the year after he started, there was a 0% death rate in the maternal clinic where the residents were doing the staffing. So this is the happy story, right? Unfortunately not, because Semmelweis was resisted at every step of the way with his ideas and his solutions by the medical establishment. First of all, what he was doing made no sense. Why would washing your hands make a difference? The dominant idea, you guys probably know this at the time, was that diseases were spread a lot of the time by miasmas, by these foul airs. We had no idea that there are these things called microorganisms that you could call germs that were really important disease vectors. So this notion that Semmelweis had, you're going to wash your hands, it was crazy talk at the time. And he was ignored. He got kicked out. He went from clinic to clinic. Everybody pushed back against him. The resistance that he encountered helped drive him around the bend. And he was declared insane. He was committed to an institution where they apparently force-fed him cod liver oil and beat the hell out of him. This is what insane asylums were like in the middle of the 19th century. He died of a gangrenous wound a few weeks after being admitted. This is a terrible story. And then as soon as he was institutionalized, they stopped hand washing at the last clinic where he was working, and the death rate skyrocketed again. It's just this tragedy when you read about it. So what did happen? Why are we fanatics about washing our hands? I don't need to tell you guys this in medicine now. It was because Louis Pasteur came around just a few years later, and he did a demonstration where he convinced the medical establishment, he convinced medicine and biology that there were these tiny little things, microorganisms, some of them were germs, they spread vectors. Pasteur did these famous demonstrations where he showed that it's not the air, it's these tiny little things that cause fermentation, that cause disease, that cause all these other things. And with relative speed, the medical establishment glommed onto that theory. They started to accept the germ theory of disease. As a result of that, people started washing their hands and putting gloves on and doing all these things. And you can watch the maternal mortality rate go down very, very quickly in the second half of the 19th century because of the germ theory of disease, because of Pasteur, not because of Semmelweis. And I tell that story early in the book to say that, look, one of the things that we need to do if people are heading down the wrong path is not just show them a better way. We have to tell them why that way is better. You have to shift the mindset. You have to give people a way to think about the problem. So one of the things I'm trying to do in my book, The Geek Way, is not just describe a set of practices that a bunch of geeky companies out west have come up with. I'm trying to explain also why they're better, because I hope that once people realize why The Geek Way is working better than what it replaced, then it will spread more quickly. I would much, much rather be Louis Pasteur than Ignaz Semmelweis.
Yeah, it's such a haunting story, not only because of the tragedy of being so close to a solution and then backing away, but I've often wondered how many of these stories in history we don't know about. We don't, people weren't listened to, they didn't get the word out, and their notes are lost to history, and they did something, and we'll never know.
We'll never know. And in many cases, I think, like Semmelweis's, what they were not able to do is convince the world why their idea was better. It's very easy to ignore a good idea if it doesn't fit into our worldview, our picture of how the world works. After Pasteur, the worldview of biology and medicine changed forever, right? And so then the good ideas could stick around. What I'm trying to do with the Geek Way is rely back on a body of, I'm not trying to create my own theory, I'm trying to fall back on a body of theory that's about the best established in the world. And that's just the good old fashioned theory of evolution. Somebody, Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, called Darwin's idea about evolution and natural selection the best idea anyone ever had. I love that. And all I'm trying to do as far as a base for talking about what the business geeks are doing is say, look, we humans are absolutely products of evolution, and we're particularly weird. We're this fantastically successful species on the planet. We are the only species that comes together in huge numbers of unrelated individuals and cooperates intensely in pursuit of a shared goal. We're it, right? We are it. The ants do that, but they're all genetically related. Every ant colony is one big family. Chimpanzees don't come together and cooperate at all. We do. That's our secret sauce. In addition to which, we learn really, really quickly. So then, like, that gives us a couple things to hold on to. First of all, we humans are simultaneously deeply self-interested and incredibly cooperative. That's the tension that we are in the middle of all the time. Because it turns out being cooperative or being seen as being cooperative is a great boost to your evolutionary fitness. It's really important to be seen as a cooperative pro-social person. And the quicker you can learn, the quicker you can figure new things out, the better that is for your fitness, for your evolutionary success. So that's where we humans are. And what I think has gone on is that a bunch of technology geeks on the West Coast of the United, primarily on the West Coast of the United States, have iterated and experimented their way into a set of practices for running a company that are a better match with our super weird, super unique human nature. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about. A quick question before we go on. You are a principal research scientist at the MIT Sloan School of Business. That's a different title than I've seen. Tell us about that. What does that mean? And not just at MIT, but in your activities outside the university.
All the job title means is that I have a research appointment at MIT. So I have this incredible good fortune that my job consists of trying to have ideas, trying to stress test them, talking about them with other people, and trying to get them out into the world. I feel super lucky that way. It's not that different from a scientist that you see anywhere else in terms of, you know, what the broad agenda is.
In this book, you touched on this a little bit, but there's no shortage of books about Silicon Valley and what's gone right and wrong there.
Yep.
What was missing in the story, and what was missing in our understanding of the success that brought this book about?
Colin, I completely agree with you. There is no shortage of books about Silicon Valley. There's no shortage of books about particular companies and the way they work, what makes them tick. And I relied on a bunch of them. What I didn't see was a book that tried to say what they had in common. What were the main similarities across these companies? Because, for example, Netflix and Amazon are very different companies. In important ways, they're very different companies, but to me, they kind of felt the same. And I wanted to elaborate on what they do that's the same. But here's the really important part. I wanted to contrast these geek similarities with the playbook that we built up for running a company over the course of the 20th century. I loosely call it the industrial era. My career as a business academic is long enough that I started my career late in the 20th century. And I initially taught from a very, very different playbook than what I saw being put into practice with all these companies. Again, primarily on the West Coast, primarily in what we call the technology space, but I didn't love those labels. And what I wanted to do was talk about this group of companies who had settled on some really, really deep commonalities, what I call them the four great geek norms, that were very, very different from what we thought was best practice, what we thought was the correct playbook over the course of the industrial era, as exemplified by, you know, companies like GE and, you know, IBM in its heyday and these giants of the industrial era. Man, the geeks do things differently. They do important things differently. And one thing I realized fairly early on was how rarely the geeks that I was hanging out with referred to the giants of the industrial era, referred to any of the classic management ideas or tenets or books or anything that I started teaching from or that I learned from late in the 20th century. The geeks out West really do believe that they're doing something different. I share that view now.
That's interesting. So if they just don't know about Jack Welch, is it because they just never bothered to look at it? Were they in high school back then like I was? I mean,
yeah. Some of the geek founders are old enough to have been around during the heyday of Jack Welch. But when they looked at what GE was actually doing and they looked at the eventual results, and think about how long and slow and sad the decline of GE was. I think consciously and subconsciously, the business geeks looked at that and said, that's actually what we want to avoid. That's what we want to not do. There's this amazing quote from Jeff Bezos in one of his shareholder letters, because Bezos goes on about how Amazon needs to always be a day one organization. It's one of his mantras, right? I forget how many hundreds of thousands of people work at Amazon now, but he's emphasizing they're a startup-y day one organization. And somebody had the really good idea to say, Jeff, what does day two look like? And so Bezos riffed on that for a while. And he said, day two is lots of things. One of the things is when you mistake the process for the proxy. And what he meant on that was when you get so fond of a thing for running the company, like Six Sigma or TQM or any of these things that kind of took over, there were mind viruses inside companies like GE. He said, then you've lost sight of it because the process is not the thing. The outcome, the thing the customer cares about, those are the thing. And what he said, what you see with day two companies is they very often get too focused on the process, and it leads them down this path that Bezos described as stasis and then irrelevance and then a long, slow, painful decline followed by death. You know, yipes. He nailed the trajectory of the classic industrial era company. We're seeing it play out in lots of cases right now. And Bezos said, that's what we are trying to avoid. We're trying to not do that. Now, think about how weird that is, because like you can imagine at Amazon, there's a lot of process, right? And people who work in Amazon warehouses don't have freedom to go pick the customer's order any way they want to. If you work at AWS and you have 99.99% reliability in your cloud services, you don't get to do whatever you want. Amazon has a ton of processes that they follow, but Bezos's brilliance and the brilliance of other people is to say, no, 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 that's not what guides us. That's not the thing. That's not the thing I want us to be good at. I want us to be good at a bias for action and a preference for taking ownership and these other leadership principles of Amazon. The process is not the thing. The process is what we need sometimes, but it's not the thing.
So the Silicon Valley corporations and groups made either conscious or unconscious effort to sort of say, okay, this corporate structure, the old style, wasn't working. We're going to rebel against it. We're going to do a different thing. We're going to try it this way. Are you aware of, I mean, the things you write about in your book are the glorious successes, sometimes followed by glorious failure, for sure, and then glorious returns. Were there Semmelweises in this group too? Are there cautionary tales or tales, there must have been, of people who thought they had the idea, but they failed and just because they couldn't get the word out?
There are a couple different kinds of failure. One is a really important distinction between a Silicon Valley company and a geek company, because I want to talk about geek companies, ones that are trying hard to follow this new playbook that I'm articulating, as opposed to the industrial era playbook. I am not here to cheerlead for Silicon Valley. Theranos was by no stretch of the imagination a geek company, as I read about their history and I read about how they were actually run. It was just about an anti-geek company. So the first thing is that Silicon Valley, there are plenty of failures for plenty of reasons, and that's not what I'm talking about. Keith, what I think is more interesting are the self-described or self-identified failures among a lot of the leaders who have eventually succeeded in creating these geek companies. Let me give you one of my favorite examples. Like I said, Amazon and Netflix are very dissimilar companies in a lot of ways, but Reed Hastings and Bezos sound similar in some really fundamental ways when they talk about their company. And in particular, both say, look, you have a responsibility to speak up if you think that we're heading down a wrong path. You have a responsibility to speak up the org chart, to be willing to be a little bit outspoken. And Hastings had been stressing that at least since 2009, when the famous Netflix culture deck, this presentation that they uploaded to SlideShare in 2009, since that was first out there. But in 2011, Hastings had an idea that was so unbelievably bad that it almost sank the company. And you guys might remember in 2011, Hastings said, here's what we're going to do. And Netflix actually did this for a while. They said, we're going to split into two companies. There are two different services. There's one called Netflix, which is going to handle the streaming. And there's one called Quickster, which is a name that Hastings came up with, that's going to manage your old-fashioned DVD queue. And if you like both of those, you have to sign up for both services. You have to maintain both queues. You have to pay about 60% more. And the world took one look at this idea and barfed all over it all the time. People started calling him Greed Hastings. There's this hilarious passage that I reproduce in the book from a review that said, you know, better ideas have been had at all night Las Vegas chapels after way too many limoncello shots. This is a terrible idea. The company lost about 75% of its market value in the space of a few months. Hastings put out this weird video where he kind of apologized for the service while maintaining it. That video got parodied by Saturday Night Live. This was a catastrophe. They eventually just said, okay, we're not doing that anymore. And they got past it. But then Hastings had the really, really good idea to look at his colleagues, his senior colleagues, the executive colleagues at Netflix, and say, team, why didn't you say anything? This is a terrible idea. Did you not think it was a terrible idea? And they're like, you know, Reed, you're a very charismatic, compelling, visionary guy. But yeah, we thought it was a terrible idea for a bunch of reasons, which turned out to be true. And then Hastings kind of said to himself, great, I have failed so far at my task of creating a company where people will speak truth to power. And it's not because he's a domineering, intimidating guy and you're fired on the spot, but he still had failed at creating a company where people would deliver him the truth as they saw it. But what I love is what Hastings did next, because he didn't say, okay, I got to work harder on having fewer stupid ideas, or I've got to go sign up for a course about leadership at a fancy business school. I say this even though I work at a fancy business school. He didn't do that. What he did instead, and this is the central geek brilliance, is to say, okay, we have to change the group level environment here. We have to stop working on making an individual better, in this case, me. That's not going to work. I'm going to have more bad ideas. And he has. What he said instead is, I need to create an environment, and I haven't done it yet. I need to create an environment where people will speak truth when a bad idea comes into the environment, even if it comes from pretty high up on the org chart. And he does not like formal policies at Netflix. It's not a super policy heavy company at all, but he's instituted a policy called farming for dissent, where before you launch a big idea, and you have great freedom to go launch stuff within your purview at Netflix, but before you go launch a big idea, you have to write it up. You have to run it by a few colleagues, and they're going to give you feedback on it. Not, hey, Colin, great idea kind of feedback. But if it's actually a lousy idea, you'll say, Keith, on a scale of positive 10 to negative 10, this is a negative 8 for the following four reasons. And that kind of policy works. And one of the reasons it works, I believe, is that we humans, because we're so weird, we've been wired in a very particular way by evolution. We're terrible evaluators of our own ideas. We're chronically, chronically overconfident for reasons that make a lot of sense. Confident people tend to do a lot better. Great. Evolution says you're overconfident. But it's a really bad idea to listen to overconfident people all the time. So we don't. We're very, very good at evaluating the ideas of other people. We're a lot less biased. We're beautiful evaluators of other people's ideas and terrible evaluators of our own ideas. And what Hastings did was harness that power, harness that group level superpower that we had, and said, great, we're going to evaluate ideas at a group. This is why science works as well as it does. And science is far from perfect, but science is really a group level argument governed by evidence ground rules. That to me is its central power, is the group level argument part. So one of the things you'll notice about geek companies, they're super argumentative. They are mouthy places. And one of my favorite questions to ask people when I go out west is, would you feel comfortable disagreeing with your boss in a meeting? And they look at me like I'm kind of an idiot. And they say, why did they hire me? Did they want me just to sit around and say, great idea, boss, all the time? And to be clear, in a lot of companies, that is the expectation, right? That's what you're supposed to do. In a lot of the companies that I've concentrated on, that is not what you're supposed to do. That's not the norm. And so things like Hastings farming for dissent are helpful with that. But the prior insight was, I'm overconfident. The things we've done so far are not working. I need to figure something else out if I'm going to achieve my goals for this organization. And over, I saw the geek leaders doing that. It's just beautiful.
So that gets us to the press secretary, which I think is just a beautiful image that you paint. We're going to get to that in just a second. I just wanted to say it because I don't want to forget about it. But we're talking about culture. Andy, I know a good culture when I see it. I love Trader Joe's. It's like one of my favorite grocery stores. There's something about the experience when you go to Trader Joe's. Everybody there is so nice. They go out of their way to help you. They ask you what you're cooking, what you're doing. It's just a unique experience. I have no idea what goes on behind the scenes. I know the parent company owns Aldi, which is a completely different experience.
Yeah.
You bag your own groceries and pay a quarter for the cart and all this stuff. Just different.
Yeah.
But I know it when I see it. But there have been some attempts to measure this and quantify this using data. So one you highlight in here is using data sets from Glassdoor, which if you're not aware, that's just a, you can rate your employer kind of website. There's 9 key values that they identify here. And then they use different techniques to evaluate how those values are ranked by employees in a company. Tell us briefly about this. And I have a question at the end here because customer is not as high as I would have thought on here.
Yeah, it's
wild. Probably some reasons, but it had me thinking a lot about this weekend. Tell us about this.
This was some research that I came across as I was doing my research for The Geek Way, and it's beautiful work done by a brother team, Don and Charlie Saul. And they dove in on the problem that you just identified, which is that culture is incredibly hard to measure. You kind of know it when you see it. You know if you wander around for a while, but most of us don't get to wander around inside all the companies that we're interested in. And culture is a very opaque thing from the outside. And if you wanted to assess it with any kind of objectivity, what would you do? Would you read the CEO's letter in the annual report? Yeah, that's what the communications team wants you to read. Is that reliable? Come on. Could you do a survey from the outside, let alone the inside? Maybe that would tell you some things, maybe not. Culture is a very hard thing to pin down until kind of recently when it got a lot easier. Not easy, but easier to pin down. Colin, because exactly as you say, there are these sites where employees talk about their companies, just like we talk about restaurants or we talk about the thing that we bought on Amazon. Glassdoor and other places let employees talk about their companies in usually kind of a free text way. And what the Sulls realized that this is a goldmine for assessing culture. So they did a cool machine learning analysis and they said, okay, when we read annual reports, there are 9 values that the leadership talks about over and over again. And they have to do with integrity and customer and innovation and agility and execution. And I forget what all the other ones are, but there are 9 of them. And they said, great, let's do a machine learning analysis of all the Glassdoor reviews. And the way you do this is you label a few reviews and you tell the machine learning system, this is a very positive review about agility at this company. This is a really negative review about integrity at this company. Got it? Now you go off and figure out what the patterns are in that entire body of Glassdoor reviews. And right now with the machine learning technologies we have, you can do that pretty easily. And so the Sulls came up with, they call it the Culture 500 research. And as far as I know, it's really the first systematic, consistent way to look at this squishy thing called culture across a large number of companies. So I reached out to Don Saul, who I've known for a while, and I said, hey, I put this big ask on him as one academic to another. I'm like, can I have your data? And he, super gracious, way beyond the professional norm. He said, yeah, here's a cross-section of our data. So I got to use it a little bit. The aspects of culture that I was most interested in are innovation, agility, and execution. Those are 3 things that very directly help you succeed in a competitive marketplace. And I was able to do some analysis and figure out that I couldn't quite, you know, look at geek companies because that's a circular definition, but I could look at technology companies and internet companies, and compared to all the other industries out there, they are off the charts in the combination of agility, execution, and innovation in the eyes of their own employees compared to other industries. So something is going on in the tech space. They are creating cultures that encourage and foster these really important things to a greater extent than we see in other industry groups. That gave me a lot of confidence that I was actually onto something here.
And I would love to see this for hospital systems and other companies, but that's a look into that.
So you all turn out to be, I'm not going to try to summarize this Culture 500 research, go look it up. Healthcare turns out to be actually pretty high on integrity because yes. you all take keeping us healthy and not killing us very, very seriously. Innovation, agility turn out to be quite low inside healthcare in a lot of cases. If it makes you feel better, you're not as bad as finance, but I think you're kind of below the average.
Well, so I was going to ask you this question. I almost answered it over the weekend. So customer, in my business, I work in the medical device space. So my customers are not only important to me, but I'm in their face all the time, at least traditionally through most of my career. So Keith was once one of my customers. So he used one of my systems for his patients. And I thought, how can, maybe this works in technology, but in other industries, the customer still would come much higher on this list. And I was listening to an interview over the weekend with a design surgeon for, you know, some other company he had started up, and it's less important about what it is, but he discussed a project he was involved with a very large medical device company. And he said, basically what they did for this screw system is they got every KOL, their key opinion leaders, input, and they didn't rank it. They just put everything into the system. So instead of having a nice, tight, efficient system that's maybe two trays of instruments, doesn't take up a lot of room in the OR and doesn't create all of this friction, this system he was involved in got to like 23 trays, which is huge.
Ooh.
And it's because they couldn't tell no to any of their most important customers. Ah. And this is where, because I thought, okay, Apple, I know Steve Jobs says we know what's right for the customer. Yeah. And it turns out he is. I thought the watch was dumb, and now I have one. I thought the iPad was dumb. They turn out to be right. So it's not that they don't care about their customers, Andy, right? It's that there's I don't know, there's a different outlook. I mean, that's my story, but tell me what your take of this is.
The short answer is I don't know, because when I think about the companies that take best care of me, they're almost all geek companies. Amazon is a phenomenal customer service organization. Netflix takes great care of me as a customer. Google does the same. We use it as a verb. I'd be lost trying to live my life or do my job without Google anymore. These are amazing customer service companies. For some reason, they don't think of themselves as deeply customer oriented. Organizations. And I don't have a great answer for you. Don Sull said it's because a lot of people that work there do not interface with the company, with the customer directly. And in a lot of cases, there are multiple customer groups. For Uber, for example, you and I as riders are an important customer group, but drivers are also a customer of Uber. So with these multi-sided platforms, it can get a little bit weird. Who do we mean when we talk about the customer? But all that is to say, I don't know why the geeks think of themselves in general as not being super customer oriented, because I feel like as a group, they take really good care of me.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah. But we could go off on that rabbit hole for a while, but I want to talk about status and confidence. You spent some time on this and it's very interesting. So I think you had a quote from Tom Wolfe, and I actually watched the Netflix special about him over the weekend, which was great. It was based off of Michael Lewis's Vanity Fair article and an interview with them. And at least his take was that Tom Wolfe throughout his career started to realize status was one of the key drivers of human behavior. And that's really what he explored a lot in his writings. So with The Right Stuff, the famous book about the early astronauts before the Apollo era.
Yeah.
They all sounded like Chuck Yeager when you got on an airplane because they all wanted to be Chuck Yeager and they adopted his accent even to that extreme. But tell us what status means in the group dynamics that you describe and the relationship with confidence and how we show confidence.
Yeah, there's this great quote in the movie House of Games from the 80s. David Mamet movie, wrote the screenplay for it. And it's about a con game, which is short for a confidence game. And in it, the con man says to his mark, he's trying to explain the nature of his craft to this person. And he says, it's called a confidence game. Why? Because you give me your confidence? No, because I give you mine. And I love that line because it summarizes what confidence is for. Confidence, if we have it, it makes other people want to be with us. It makes them want to ally with us, to partner with us, to you know, go conquer the enemies or do whatever it increases our standing in the eyes of other people. Confidence is there for a social reason. Now, the more confidence you have, the better off you'll be. It's like status in that sense. More of it is better for your position inside a group. And so a neat trick would be that if you could look confident all the time, even when it wasn't warranted. And evolution said, great, we can do that. We're just going to make people chronically overconfident. And you think, well, people will see through that. And that's true. But then is a better strategy not to try to appear confident, to be, you know, the least confident person in the room because you're the only honest one? That's a terrible evolutionary strategy. So we get in this arms race about overconfidence. It is the easiest cognitive bias to elicit. It's one of the hardest ones to train away. And it just seems like this deep flaw in our wiring until you realize what it's there for. It's not a bug, it's a feature. And once you realize about us human beings as these crazy social beings, confidence and overconfidence become really easy to understand. So does our thirst for status, because we are the most social species on the planet. And for all other social birds and for vertebrates, birds and mammals, status is incredibly important. The higher status males and females have greater reproductive success. It's amazing news for your genes, for your evolutionary fitness, if you are high status. It's ridiculous. You almost don't need to talk about it. Great. So we human beings are overconfident, status-obsessed individuals. And that gives us a lot of things to work with. One of the things, though, that we should expect is that in a company, which is this very abstract notion, the goals of the company are not going to be perfectly aligned with the goals of the individuals that make up that company. And I think one of the biggest divergences is the goals of the company are growth and profitability. Great. The goals of the human beings involved are status. Status is like 1, 2, 3, and 4, and resources is maybe number 5. So we all want higher pay, but what we really, really want is higher pay than that jerk down the hallway from us, right? So resources are a relative thing. They're not an absolute thing. We evaluate each other's wealth, resources, by a ladder on a status hierarchy. So when we look at us as these status-obsessed individuals, this chronic problem of bureaucracy becomes easier for me to understand, because bureaucracy isn't designed by the CEO. I talk about in the geek way this astonishing example that I found where a manager at Hewlett-Packard in 2005 talks about trying to get her job done. And she has to hire some consultants and spend about $250,000 of Hewlett-Packard's money on it. Okay, great. You got to have approvals for that level of spending. So she says, I put in the approval request and I sat back. And the system said, okay, you need to get 20 signatures for this. This is not spending $250 million, right? This is a trivial amount of money for an organization the size of HP. But she's got to go get 20 signatures. And she said, it was my boss. My boss's boss, my boss's boss's boss. And then these weird people in weird parts of the company that I had never heard of before. And she tracked down the last couple signatures she needed to an office in Acapulco, Mexico. And she started calling them up every day because otherwise her project was going to slip. And she finally got the last signature that she needed. And she said, the person who I was talking to, the final signature, she and I developed such a relationship that this person asked me for a LinkedIn endorsement somewhere down the road. Now, I guarantee you, nobody at HP got out a blank sheet of paper and designed a 20-step approval process. Nobody designed the company to frustrate that person trying to get her job done. But that 20-step approval, 20-signature approval process is what happens as people in groups get together, they vie for status. When there's an overspend, someone says, wow, we ought to have greater oversight so we don't have these kinds of bad things. My office needs to be involved. We got to approve all spending over $10,000, $50,000, $100,000, whatever. And because of people, mainly subconsciously, these are not, you know, deliberately Machiavellian people scheming for higher status. We are just wired to insert ourselves into things and to become part of approval loops and to have ideas run past us and to be in the room all the time because we want status. Bureaucracy is ultimately, I think, the result of status-seeking individuals doing what they do. And one of the great geek insights at some level is to realize that and to fight super hard against the constant encroaching bureaucratization of companies and organizations all over the place. They're kind of fanatics about it in some very healthy ways. And one of their main weapons for fighting it is they do a couple of things. One is to try very hard to make sure that the way to get ahead at the company is aligned with the goals of the company, right? Slowing down approvals is not really well aligned with the goals of the company. However, you know, launching the Starlink internet satellite service is pretty well aligned with the goals of SpaceX. Great. You had a huge success with Starlink. That's really good news for your career. You want to become the bureaucrat that approves all spending over $100. Yeah, we don't, that's not going to be so great. You might not have a great career at SpaceX or other great geek companies. So one thing they do is try to strip away other opportunities to get status and limit those opportunities to things that are aligned with the goals of the company. Another thing they do is try to build very modular organizations. And so you hear about this with things like two pizza teams and single-threaded leaders at Amazon. They've designed it so that the unit at Amazon is a very small group. That's why they were called two pizza times. No more people than could be fed with two large pizzas. They're a little bigger than that now sometimes. But the goal is to have that organization, that team, have everything it needs, all the resources it needs, and not to have to go ask for permission or resources or access or anything from the rest of this gigantic corporation. This is a massive rethink from how we thought about organizations in the 20th century. Just this inherently modular, very decoupled approach. It works for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is it just gives bureaucracy fewer places to take root.
Yeah, speaking of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, and you know him because he wrote the foreword to your book.
He did. He volunteered. I asked him for a blurb and he said, hey, how about a foreword? That was the easiest question I've ever been asked in my career, I think.
Congrats.
That's very cool. It was beautiful. It's short, but he nailed it. Like, he wrote my book in 2 pages. And he said, to one of your earlier questions, he said, my fellow geeks and I never spent much time thinking about what distinguished us from the rest of the economy, from the economy that we came from. And he said, and this is the point of this book. This is what Andy's taken on here. And so I agree, right? But I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm curious about people like him, Eric Schmidt, others that you know, the CEO of HubSpot.
Yeah, Brian Halligan.
If I was working for CNBC and I'm interviewing one of these people, there's a very different goal set there, right? You know, I want to get them to address some issue that's going on with their stock, right? Sure. You know, it's extractive, but you're coming at it a little different as a researcher. I think you have a unique role in what you do. You've developed these relationships over time. I'm curious, I understand if you're sitting down with Reid Hoffman and you're asking him about LinkedIn and getting a better understanding of how they do what they do. What questions do they ask you, Andy? Because I know they do. Like, what do they gain from you? Because to me, you're a cross-pollinator. You're someone who can pull from different areas. But tell me about, take us into one of these meetings, what they're like.
There are parts of writing a book that are not fun. The interviews that I did with my favorite alpha geeks were so much fun because, like you said, I got to ask them the questions that were top of mind for me. And the norm out west is if you get an introduction from somebody, if you get an introduction to an alpha geek from somebody they know, their default becomes, yes, I will give you some time. They were remarkably generous with their time. And I had these fascinating discussions, a lot of which I tried to condense and put in the book. But the main thing they asked me is some version of, are we really that different than what's going on in the rest of the economy, right? Are these differences really that stark? And they actually did a great job of pushing back on my main thesis. And in particular, Patrick Collison, who's co-founded Stripe when he was 21 years old and is now taking over disrupting the online payments industry. He said, look, I'm not sure I buy your central thesis that we figured this out. We're still making all kinds of mistakes. We're a young company. We could become sclerotic. We could become bureaucratic as we get older. And there's this kind of very interesting humility going on. So they wanted to debate me in general, not about their awesomeness, but Andy, are you sure about this? Are you sure about our awesomeness? Because even, you know, the alpha geeks of Silicon Valley are not tremendously humble people overall. They've accomplished a great deal, but they do not think that they've discovered the corporate fountain of eternal youth. And they love to argue. So more than asking me questions, they kind of push back on my basic idea and say, yeah, I'm not so sure about that. And I got a lot smarter as a result.
That's fascinating. Totally off topic, but I think about status and how people communicate with each other on LinkedIn. I wonder if anyone's done research on that or thinking about it, because they would know, but you know, If I got Eric Schmidt to respond to me on something on LinkedIn, for example, it'd be a lot different than just another colleague, you know. But
yeah, completely. And like I said, you have to get an introduction, you have to get into that network somehow, because these are extraordinarily busy people. But one idea out of this discipline that studies us as a product of evolution that I love is that in addition to dominance, and all social vertebrates that have a dominance hierarchy, there's an alpha chimp, and the alpha chimp is the alpha because he can beat up the beta, the gamma, and everybody else. I'm oversimplifying like crazy, but it's a dominance hierarchy. It's not very subtle. We human beings have dominance hierarchies. We absolutely do. And we're very wired to see who has, who's dominant over who. We got that. We have another kind of status. And I think we're largely unique in the animal kingdom for it. We have prestige. And that comes not from your ability to beat the snot out of me, but man, are you really good at what you do? In a crowd of people, I am very good as a human being. I'm good at picking out who's good at the thing that I want to get good at. And I start mimicking you, and I pay attention to you, and I defer to you. And it doesn't feel like oppression to me. I want to subconsciously, in general, I want to become your apprentice. Here's the cool part.
Kids do this as well, right?
Sorry? Kids do this like crazy. We do it all over, and it doesn't stop when we get older. But here's, I think, the really interesting wrinkle. There's a theory that I love that says when you become more successful, when you become more prestigious, you also become more pro-social. You become more cooperative. And maybe one way to think about it is once you've arrived, you got some time, you're willing to give back, you want to teach other people, and you become a better teacher, a more cooperative, pro-social person. I've experienced this a lot. I talk about it in the book a little bit. Yo-Yo Ma is an extraordinarily high status person, not because of his physical dominance. I think I could take Yo-Yo Ma. I don't want to run that experiment. I think I could take Yo-Yo Ma. But he's got so much prestige, and he is the menschiest guy that you've ever met. He's just a warm, wonderful, giving human being. And I'm like, oh, evolution, you really nailed that one. Thank you very much.
I've observed the same thing some of the people we've had on the podcast. I mean, it's one, if you're showing a genuine curiosity in what they're doing, they really appreciate that. It means a lot to them. But, yeah. You know, you could be talking to a 4-star general and you know he was a little different in the field than he is when he's talking to you. But
yeah,
I think
totally.
They've gotten to a point in their career, especially if they're retired, that they've adapted in a little way and they don't have to prove themselves to anyone.
I think that I agree. But one thing that a bunch of my Alpha Geek interviewees told me was there is a time for a dominance hierarchy. When the company's going through a tough time, we're not going to sit around and debate everything in kind of a very egalitarian way. I want to hear from people, but someone has to make a call. I'm the person on top of the org chart. I'm going to make that call. That's a dominance relationship. But they don't want to spend all their time in that way. And to be unfair, you know, over the course of the industrial era, I think a lot of people had the goal of climbing the management hierarchy so that you could be dominant over everybody else and everybody had to listen to you and you didn't have to suffer any backtalk. The geeks are like, that's actually not what leadership is, man. Leadership is using your prestige in the right ways.
That's right. That's right.
There's a little bit of a paradox here, though, because you're talking about the status, you're talking about the fact that there are people who you want to emulate or the sort of leaders. And yet part of the geek way is that you don't want to listen to the opinion leadership necessarily to make the decisions. You want it based on science. So how do you get people who are, you know, definitely not dominated, but definitely strongly influenced by the people who are ahead of them, Reed Hastings of the world and people like that. And how do you get them to say, no, wait, we can't listen to that. We have to let the data drive.
It's a great question. I think the behavior of leaders matters even more than we think it does. We all know that leaders' behavior matters. I think we still lowball it because we humans are so attuned to what high status individuals are doing. We are wired by evolution to pay conscious and especially subconscious attention to what the high status people are doing. That if there are high status people who say, why are you saying that? What's the evidence? Or even more rare, oh, that's a good point. You made a strong argument. You backed it up with evidence. I guess I was wrong about that. We're going to go your way. That is not the classic Jack Welch kind of leadership behavior, if I'm being, you know, a little bit unfair, but I've heard the geeks do this over and over again. So it's something that the person at the top of the org chart does. It's something that a high status person does, but what they can do is demonstrate that we're going to follow this norm of science, of having an evidence-based argument and then going where the evidence takes us.
Yeah, you call this the distributed self-correction mechanism, which I think is a perfect description. I mean, it's a built-in internal control to protect your business.
That's one of them. And one of the best books I read as I was trying to get smart about this was a book called The Knowledge Machine, which is about this phenomenon of science, right? And it says that's where science is, this self-correction mechanism. Another one, I believe, is openness, is the psychological safety to say, hey, we are not following our mission statement anymore. That thing that's up there on the wall that we say is so important, we're not living that anymore. You have to work very hard to create an organization, especially where low status people feel comfortable saying that to high status people. That is constant, really difficult work. And some of the geeks I respect most, my friend, Brian Halligan, the founding CEO of HubSpot, is one that I've seen do this in person, is just brilliant at saying, oh yeah, good point. I hadn't thought of that. And in this very genuine, open way.
Boy, we're getting close on the time, and there's so much more to talk about. But Keith, is there anything else you wanted to?
No, I mean it's such a fascinating idea. It makes so much sense. But the idea, the question about how you get systems to sort of follow it, how you get people to step in and make this happen. We're particularly in the medical field where. Yeah. We really are, very much run by, well, as Colin was saying, the company that didn't want to upset any of their customers, so built everything into the system, even though that wasn't necessarily science-driven. It certainly wasn't speed or innovation-driven. And as you point out, that's low. I think it's going to take another level of culture. I'd be interested to see if we're seeing different responses or different understanding of the geek norms among, for instance, the younger students in your business school compared to some of the old grads. Be fascinating. You know, surveys don't work, but fascinating to see if there's an understanding and acceptance change.
I think there is. I think there is a demographic shift going on. I do find that the younger people are inherently a little, you know, more egalitarian or a little more comfortable speaking their minds. As you point out, this is not easy to do for a lot of organizations, probably for most organizations. The geek way is a little bit unnatural because, for example, it says to high status people, stop acting like dominant individuals, right? Act like prestigious individuals, but you don't get to beat up the every layer below you on the org chart as a perk of your job. That's not what you're there for. Even more fundamentally, you are not there to make the tough calls based on your judgment or your experience or your intuition. That's actually, in most cases, that's not your job. I have a wonderful quote from Carl Bass, former CEO of Autodesk, who I've learned a ton from. And he said, by the end of my tenure as the CEO there, I wasn't making very many decisions. I didn't see that as my job anymore. Man, I love that. So a lot of these behaviors are unnatural. And the geek way is a way to push back against the features of our wiring that get an organization into trouble. This relentless quest for status, this overconfidence, this tendency to bureaucratize things because we want to be part of the work. These are all very understandable. They're very natural, and a lot of them will get in the way of running a successful company. And the geeks try to channel our biases instead of just, you know, train them away or scold them away. That doesn't work.
Well, we are almost at time. So, of course, I wanted to ask you more about freedom of expression and how you maintain that in an organization. And even at the university, we weren't going to get into what happened last week in MIT, but there's just a lot in the news. But we're going to have to leave that to another time because it's time.
We can pick this conversation up if we want to, and I would love to.
We'd love to have you back, Andy. And thank you again for jumping on so quickly. I was so excited to have you, and I know why. It was a great conversation. But to wrap things up, just tell everybody who's listening where they can learn more about your work, where, of course, they can find your book and explore more on this.
My book is called The Geek Way. It's available wherever fine books are sold. I'm A. McAfee on Twitter, A-M-C-A, F like Frank, E-E. And I'm going to be, one of my goals for 2024 is to spin up a Substack and start shooting my mouth off there about these kinds of topics. So I try to be fairly easy to find online. Please let me know what you think.
Andy, thanks so much. It's as always, everyone, we're going to get all that in our show notes. I'll look out for the Substack, get that on there too. And like I said, next week's Christmas. So thanks for squeezing this in here. This is a great episode to wrap up 2023 here. And
thank you. I agree. And I really appreciate you having me on such short notice. And Keith and Colin and your listeners, happy holidays, gentlemen. This has been a blast.
Likewise. Happy holidays, everyone. And whenever, wherever you're listening, take care. We'll see you here next time.
Thanks for joining us on Peer Spectrum. Please support the show by writing a review on iTunes and join the conversation at peerspectrum.com. Keep up with the latest episodes and share your ideas with us on Twitter, Facebook, or email at peerspectrum.com.